So you did something really impressive that I don't think you're entirely aware of. Do you happen to know what that is?
I'm going to pretend that I don't.
Because that's the magic of the... Or breaking the illusion, but we just redid this. Everybody was appropriately excited and in endorsing the Bear as being a fantastic television show. And it's a show that I parceled out, right? Like, I'm not a binge watcher of TV, and this was a show that I actually don't think I agree with. Well, actually, sorry, real quick. This is not going to be a spoiler-laden conversation, and I think we'll probably cap it at 5 minutes. So we're going to speak vaguely about it, but if you are somebody who does want to avoid spoilers, just fast forward to like the six-minute mark, and it'll be fine. But I don't actually think it was as intense as people say. Kept saying it was like an intense or difficult watch. I don't necessarily agree with that. And also, I guess maybe that's because this and Succession probably, I would say, are two of the best shows of the past 20 years. So maybe that I'm predisposed to liking shows of that nature. But yeah, do you stand by that? I'm not sure if you made that claim, but that the show was sometimes challenging to watch or very intense.
Oh, yeah. For sure. Not every minute of every episode, but at points, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe there's some personal stuff going on, but yeah, I didn't always find it that stressful. I thought it had a level of seriousness, and it very effectively conveyed like manic situations in a way that didn't seem glossed over. There's particularly an episode in the first season, which is all just a single 20-minute shot.
Love that. Yeah.
It's a real, real good show. Mm-hmm. But can you, and again, no spoilers, but can you think of what I'm surprised did not slip from you, or frankly, anybody, or maybe this is only that interesting and pleasing to me?
What was it that your boy,
the boy,
what's his name? Is it Rob Mahoney? Am I getting that right? What was in one of the episodes?
Who's Rob Mahoney?
Am I not getting his name right?
Are you thinking of Patrick Mahomes?
Definitely not thinking of him, especially not this one.
Is that how you spell his name? Or how you spell his name? How you pronounce his name?
Patrick Mahomes.
Is it Mahomes or Mahomes?
It's not Mahomes. I think that is a nickname of
his. Is it Mahomes?
Mahomes. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. And he plays for the who?
For the team that the 49ers are playing in the Super Bowl this weekend, the Kansas City Chiefs.
Wait. Well, maybe we'll have to go back and edit the people should fast forward 10 minutes because we're going to be on this for a second. Wait, do you like the 49ers? I thought you
didn't care. Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. No.
Since when?
I was a little kid, had a Steve Young and Jerry Rice poster in my room, and I would say they're a relatively big part of why I moved to the Bay Area. They were sort of the first vector into learning more about San Francisco.
I do not remember this. Was it also maybe were the Niners very bad in the start of the 2010s?
They made the Super Bowl in 2012.
Wasn't there a Super Bowl where it was Harbaugh v. Harbaugh?
Yeah.
What year was that?
2012.
Jesus, time keeps going.
Yeah, it does.
That's 12 years ago.
Yeah, so they were, when I was a little kid, I mean, gosh, like the last time they won the Super Bowl, like early 90s. You know, they were obviously good, and then they were bad for a while, and then they were okay for a while, and then they had, you know, the whole Harbaugh Kaepernick era, and they were good. They made the Super Bowl, then they were real bad there for a while,
and that's what I'm thinking of.
Then now, for the past number of years, they've been super, super close. Made a Super Bowl, have made the NFC Championship game 3 of the last 4 years. But have never quite gotten over the hump.
Was there a player on the Niners called Alex Smith?
Yeah, so he was the quarterback.
Was he good?
Yeah, he was. So he was a quarterback before Kaepernick, and then got he got hurt, which is then what prompted Kaepernick to play.
That's what I was going to ask: is was he one of those people who had, who was saddled with massive expectations and maybe had an unfortunate ending?
No, I mean he was a really solid quarterback. He just had it happen to him twice, actually, where with the 49ers he got hurt and then was replaced by Kaepernick, and then he ironically went to the Chiefs. And I don't recall if he got hurt, or I don't remember exactly what the circumstances were, but Mahomes then started playing, and they, you know, the Chiefs realized, oh yeah, this guy's a lot better. So Alex Smith was perfectly fine, but he just got replaced by two better quarterbacks.
Got it. So no, Rob Mahoney or whatever you said was not whatever about the show. Who is Rob Mahoney?
Who am I thinking of? The comedian in the one episode that you...
Oh, now... Okay, but who's Rob Mahoney?
I don't know. Is that not his name? Well, what's his actual name?
Rob Mahoney is somebody who writes about the Dallas Mavericks for ESPN. Is that...
Maybe. I don't know. What do
you think? He wrote a book called The Maverick Stampede about Dirk Nowitzki.
Oh, okay.
You were thinking of, why can't,
oh yes. Quick to make fun of me.
No, because I'm thinking of Rob Mahoney, John Mulaney.
Close enough.
Have you still not watched any of his specials?
Carlos, when would I do that?
You know
how much TV I have not seen. Do you think that would somehow...
Hey, you and your wife managed to find 2.5 hours a week to watch Frasier. I think you can have a 50-minute stand-up special. I think Rob Mahoney, John Mulaney would be a hit in your household. I think it's a type of comedy that would definitely speak to both of you.
Yeah, no, the bits I've seen of him, including in The Bear, he's great.
Mm-hmm. Not the most recent one, or the most recent one is more. You need some a body of work to have ingested first.
Okay.
So, but the one that takes place at the Chicago Theater is very good. But no, that was very good. But mostly, so who are the main characters of The Bear?
Oh God, where's my iPhone and call sheet when I need it?
I still haven't bought it.
I have. It's really good.
It's great, but it's kind of a lot.
I'm so bad with both actor names and character names.
So you got Carmen Brizzotto.
Carmi, yeah.
And then you got Richie, who is the cousin, yeah. Who's not a real cousin. Is that the deal?
Yeah, right.
Okay. And then you've got Sidnall, you got a whole bunch of others. So, and also the reason why I'm so surprised by this show is, have you ever heard of a show called Shameless?
It sounds maybe vaguely familiar.
So the lead actor who plays Carm, Jeremy Allen White, was in that show, and it is a show that a lot of people like, and of similar to shows that I might like. It is one of the most a show that I 100% do not get the acclaim for, and is, I think, the most objectionable show that has been released on like premium cable and ever. It's so bad, but he's amazing in this. So that was a nice surprise. But no, but cousin Richie, you managed to keep the entire situation about him and Taylor Swift a secret, and I appreciate that, even if that was unintentional.
I don't know what you're talking about.
What are you talking about?
Well, what's the connection to T-Swift?
How long ago did you watch the show?
It was like last summer, I guess.
Was season 2 out last summer?
Yeah.
Okay.
Came out I think in the spring or something.
Okay. Well, this is not a spoiler.
Is there like there's like a... Yeah, there's a scene where he like sings one of her songs or something, right?
Yeah, but there's more to it. So just like these are not spoilers, but he's divorced and he's got a kid, his ex-wife, and there's like a lot of just like little like Taylor Swift-y Easter eggs. Like there's a whole plot line of him trying to get tickets for it, and then there are two specific bits that make me that were just very endearing. where he's on a phone call to his like 6-year-old daughter, and he says, yes, sweetie, I love Taylor Swift. I just needed a break, when I guess they were mad at each other for not having it on in the car. And then there's a very powerful scene after his character makes some important self-reflection and developments. And he just semi-angrily sings Love Story in the car for like a minute. And it was just very, very good. And I'm happy that nobody spoiled that for me. It's a damn good show.
It's really, really good. Yeah.
It deserves... This is a thing that deserves someone's full attention.
Definitely.
And again, I have my strong opinions about binging, but this is a show that exceptionally not bingeable, or should not be, because that's disrespectful to it. And not for the same reason, again, that people are talking about. Like, I think even Mike remarked on this, is like, oh, you can't binge it because it's just too much to watch. I don't agree with. I just think it's that these are like 30-minute, like, really in-depth, like, masterful pieces of story that deserve to be, like, you know, ruminated on a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the thing that I really, really liked about that show, too, is, again, no spoilers, really, but season one and season two are just so different from each other. I mean, the plots really are, I mean, obviously, it's all connected, but very, very different from season one to season two. Again, no spoilers, but there's a, you know, thing that kind of happens at the end of season one, which then sets the show in a different direction. And mm-hmm. I would say sort of like stylistically too, season two is just, it's just very different than season one. Like season one's got more of like the frantic thing to it. And then season two has that at points, but it's just, just different, I guess, is where I would leave it.
It's more ambitious, but also more structured.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really, really good.
So, yeah. So, it's that you can find, because of our current streaming environment, it's a FX original on Hulu as part of the Disney Plus family of products.
Rolls right off the tongue. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Another really good thing, too, which is also, I think, unique to season two. I can't immediately think of any examples of this from season one, but, you know, they do the thing where they've got basically like one-off episodes. I mean, they do, you know, forward the main plot in some way, but, you know, there's the episode with Marcus that's really, really good. There's the episode with your boy Richie that's really good.
There's
the Christmas episode, of course.
I disagree. Not that they're not great, but I don't. You're correct, but I don't think the show is serialized at all. So therefore, you are correct that there may be like sort of like mini movies, or they're like somewhat siloed away, but I'm not actually sure that's terribly different than season one.
Season one, I thought, had just more of a, I guess, sort of almost traditional structure. Mm-hmm. Whereas season two had like each episode, or when, not every episode, but a handful of the episodes were in a lot of ways like their own thing.
Sure, but not in a bad way. Like,
not a bad way. In fact, you know, like the Marcus episode is, you know.
Well, but I think that's my point where, like, because hot take, I think actually Ted Lasso was a bad show. But in the same way that there was like...
I don't feel like that's really that hot of a take anymore, but...
No, but I think I liked it at the time. I'm objectively thinking it was a bad show. I think it's a thing that a lot of people wanted during the pandemic, and maybe the feel good, the hollow feel goodness of that show. It doesn't hold up, and I think it was genuinely kind of a bad show.
Well, it also did the thing where the quality of it, you know, gradually went down over time, and that happens to a lot of TV shows. So
yeah,
I think that's a main thing it's got working against it.
But I think like the like Richie's episode, and which I think the episode was called Forks, which is maybe one of the best episodes of TV in a real, real, real long time. Mm-hmm. Is in the is it what country is Copenhagen in? Or is Copenhagen a country? Don't cancel me. Is it Sweden, Switzerland, Denmark? Is Denmark the same as Sweden? Denmark. I'm not a geographer.
Clearly not. Yeah.
It's right next to Sweden.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
I don't think it is kind of like its own entirely self-contained thing, but not in the same way that like there were like a fair number of like weird Ted Lasso episodes that were entirely self-contained and were not additive and could be entirely skipped and taught you nothing.
Well, but Ted Lasso had the thing, particularly in season two, where
they expanded the episode order or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. So they literally had two episodes that were like, you know, story-wise and just sort of like literally separate from the rest of the season for, you know, business reasons.
Yeah. So yeah, great show, amazing cinematography, just real, real, real good. And again, not a huge commitment. It's most episodes are about 30 minutes. Some are a little bit longer. First season is 8 episodes. Second season is 10. And again, just make the watch it over a week. Don't binge it. It's really, really good.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
One other thing related to media that I completely forgot about until just now. I watched your boy Christy Nolan's movie, The Dark Knight.
Oh, that's right.
For 2 weeks.
What did you think?
So, I don't think I have ever watched an entire superhero movie. Mm-hmm. In my entire life.
Right.
Okay. This is a complicated answer. I would say, how do you rate movies? Most movies, I remember as a kid when you watched, like there was like an ad for something during a sports event. Like it would say, like if a critic really loved a movie, they would say 4 out of 4 stars and the max was 4 stars.
Mm.
How do you... How can I give a defining value to rate this? Give a letter grade? Okay, fine.
Sure. I think that works.
I'm going to give it a B.
Okay.
I think, so here's the thing. I watched it not on my Vision Pro. I watched it on the C7 OLED. This is a movie. I watched it in 4K. And whatever the nice release was, this movie looks fucking amazing on an OLED. It is so well, like is mastered the term or colored or just whatever. It is so good. It's beautiful. It's real good. I couldn't tell which segments were supposed to be IMAX. I do think the aspect ratio sometimes changed from 16:9 to 1.78. I think there's a I never went square, which I think was your point about.
Oh no! Well, IMAX screens are more square, but you know, home video releases that have IMAX footage in them obviously don't do that. But what they do is exactly what you just described: is they change the aspect ratio where the IMAX filmed portions, you know, fill your entire HD screen.
So basically, it does the cinematic anamorphic 2.3:1 ratio for most of the movie, and the stuff that would have been kind of squarish in IMAX becomes 16:9.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yep. Yeah, it like in terms of like actually here's the part that I didn't know about that I did want to circle back with you about, which is that this was made in 2008,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep.
I don't know where we were in terms of like CGI. How much of this movie was CGI? Because that feels early where, like, I assume, and again, I'm never going to watch it. What's a Fantastic Four? What's the big Marvel franchise? The Avengers? Like, if I were to watch, like, from 3 years ago, a Disney big budget movie, I assume those movies are, like, 99% green screen CGI. Right?
Yeah. Yep.
How much of The Dark Knight was that?
I mean, basically none. That's another one of Nolan's things, is he's very heavy on the practical effects and uses minimal CGI.
Okay.
That's kind of true of most of his movies.
So yeah, like looked great, mm-hmm. sound great. It was a very enjoyable movie in that regard. And I was like in awe frequently in terms of just how nice it looked.
Good pace to it, right?
Yeah. I looked online. Apparently people don't like Maggie Gyllenhaal, and I think she's a national treasure, so I don't care for that. But
she got bad hand that she was dealt, because her character was recast, so she did not play, again, demonstrating my lack of memory with character names and stuff. She did not play the character that she was portraying in the original movie. And I'm looking this up right
now. Sorry, so she replaced somebody else, not she was replaced because people.
So her character name Rachel. So she, Katie Holmes played Rachel in the first one, and then I guess there was contract stuff or something. So then Maggie Gyllenhaal stepped in for The Dark Knight.
Okay,
so that was probably part of the blowback there.
Yeah, and I guess I have zero, like literally, again, we joke that I know 19% of everything, or somehow the percentage kept going down over time.
And it's like, I thought it's that like was 14% offense. Of everything.
It started at like 33, and then you keep making it go down. It's kind of fucked up. Mm-mm. But I legitimately, not in the way that I pretend to know nothing about football, I don't know anything about superheroes or Batman. And also, one, it was funny a couple of years ago, everybody was like, I was wondering, like, oh, why is this movie called The Batman? And it's just, apparently in this movie, they also will frequently include the article, the, in referring to what I thought was kind of like in the way that Apple calls study, they insist that you say, this movie was shot on iPhone. Yeah.
Yeah. No, the allowed with Apple.
Right? Yeah. I always thought that's how you referred to Batman, but apparently no, a lot of times you put the Batman.
Yep.
Yeah. So anyway, what was my point here? So yeah, I have no knowledge of superheroes or Batman at all. So I did not, I had heard the name Harvey Dent before. No idea where it was from. Okay. Apparently Aaron Eckhart, good role, good act. Mm-hmm. Everything's great there.
Yep.
But yeah, it was, I would say like the story and like writing, not terribly complex.
No. Yeah.
I mean, not that it's supposed to be that, but I mean, that was the one thing I was like, actually this is very basic. Like, mm-hmm. but it also didn't seem like what I assume is why I would hate like a Marvel movie, is that there was a lot of action, and a lot of it was maybe like superfluous action, but it wasn't just like noise and explosions. Like it was a good balance, but I assume that's what a Marvel movie is.
Well, but this is why Batman is the best superhero. And it's why with the Marvel stuff, to try to connect it to that, Iron Man is the best member of the Avengers, and the thing that they have in common with each other is they don't have any superpowers. They're just people. And in both the case of Batman and Iron Man, they're just like rich dudes who have a lot of cool tech and stuff. And that's just way more interesting than some, you know, superhero that's just got a bunch of unexplained magical powers, which I also tend to not find all that interesting.
Also on that note, because of the age of the movie, I did find it funny or just kind of weird that the Batmobile was not an EV or just of some sort. It just feels like, yeah, this doesn't age well.
Well, even in the Batman, which is the kind of latest reboot of Batman, the Batmobile is not an EV.
So yeah, I mean, story. C plus, like just because it just wasn't terribly interesting. Like it was all novel to me because I had never seen any of it before. But like it was kind of meh. I don't know. I thought it was fine, but it was a real good, beautiful movie. Mm-hmm. From every other respect, and I assume you would not be able to say that there are other superhero movies of that same quality. If I told you like, not just being like Michael Bay style bright noises and or bright colors, explosions and noises is not my thing, I assume you would say there are probably no superhero movies that fit that bill, unless you're going to tell me to watch the whole Batman prequel trilogy or whatever, which I'm probably not going to do. This took me like 9 years to get to. So let's not.
Yeah. I'd say the Nolan Batman trilogy is very unique. I really can't think of another recent superhero movie that would be comparable. It really is its own thing. And then in terms of that trilogy, the first movie is really, really good. And I would say stylistically similar to The Dark Knight. The third one goes off the rails a little bit. I think, unfortunately, in part because of obviously, you know, what happened with Heath Ledger. Mm-hmm. You know, he, I think, would have played a bigger role in the third movie, which undoubtedly would have made that third movie a lot better than it ended up being. So the third one's kind of hard to recommend. But the first two are fantastic.
Was the first one called Batman Begins?
Batman Begins. Yep.
Okay. Maybe the next sick day.
Yeah.
Anyway, but thank you for the recommendation. And now I think legally you're required to go watch a John Mulaney special, but like it was better than
who? Rob Mahoney. That was, it's good. I'm trying to think of actually like other Christopher Nolan movies.
I've actually watched, cause I, you know, that show, that website that John Siracusa loves, I've actually started using Letterboxd. I've actually watched way more movies than I thought this year. I think I watched like 30 movies, which is probably more than I've watched in last decade. Not having kids. It's, yeah, if you have other recommendations, I will take it under advisement.
I'm trying to think of Christopher Nolan.
Oh, that was my point. Sorry, I've never seen Inception. I think I've made this condescending thing before. It feels like in my interpretation of it is that it's a dumb person smart movie.
I disagree with that.
How far off am I?
I'd say you're pretty far off.
It's got complexity and layers.
Oh yeah, for sure. Well,
but my whole thing is I've heard that there's this like ominous warping music plays, and then they just keep like, I think I already know what the twists are just based on popular culture, I guess.
Maybe. Okay. But that one I don't think you'd really care for. I think Interstellar you would like. Which on paper, I could see you pushing back against that. But I think if you actually sat down and watched it, I do think you'd really like it.
I think we talked about this last time, and I said, actually, this was a solid maybe because it's got Jessica Chastain in it. And it probably has great black holes on an OLED.
Well, I was going to say that. Yeah, that looks real good on an OLED for sure. This is all making me really want to see Oppenheimer, which I have also still not seen.
Isn't that now on Max?
It's coming to... No, remember, Nolan had the big falling out with Warner Brothers Discovery, so...
Don't they still own it?
It's coming
out.
Is
that his choice?
No, he, I guess... I don't know if he had finished his commitment with them or if he was just going movie by movie or what the deal was, but Oppenheimer is a... NBC Universal thing. Mm. So it's coming out on Peacock, or maybe already is out on Peacock. It's sometime in February.
I don't know why I feel like Peacock is like an also, like it's basically like a Tubi. Oppenheimer being on Peacock feels very, yeah. Mm. Anyway,
glad you watched it.
Yeah, good movie rec.
Good opening scene, right? Good first 10 minutes.
Well, yeah, again, I had no context for what Batman is, so I didn't really know mm-hmm. what it was going to be. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Batman is the best superhero. I won't hear any objections to that.
Okay. All right. Was there anything else? What's something that you can talk about before we end up going back to? Well, actually, no, let's just keep it going. So we have a whole ton of streaming stuff we haven't talked about in a while. And actually, there was some some breaking news today, which is something that you will be very interested in. And has kind of been your hobby horse for the past couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Is that what you want to jump to?
Oh yeah, we'll go back to the Perfect Tech thing because I've talked for a very long time.
Okay. So you want to start with like the late breaking news today?
Yeah, because sports and streaming has been your beat for a very long time.
It's true. Yeah. So ESPN, Fox, and Warner came out today and announced that they're going to do in the business world, what they're calling a joint venture, where they're going to have a new standalone service where effectively all of the sports rights that the three of them own are going to come together under a single app. So, you know, anything that you could watch on ESPN is going to be on this thing. Anything that you'd watch on TNT is going to be on this thing. Anything that you watch, you know, on Fox is going to be this thing, like FS1 or, you know, Fox proper, which is really, I mean, I guess starting with the positive is really interesting, and goes, you know, at least part of the way towards solving the problem, which I think is becoming clear to all three of these companies, which is in a, you know, post cable bundle world, how realistic is it going to be for all of the various sports rights holders to go off and, you know, try to silo their content into their own platform? I mean, all of these same companies are kind of learning through their, you know, non-sports stuff that's been a sort of a challenging proposition to sell to consumers. It's confusing. It's expensive. It requires people to, you know, pay for various services, and especially, you know, younger generations not real interested in doing that. So, you know, bringing these sports rights into a single app, I think makes a lot of sense just from a, you know, ease of use perspective. You know, they've mentioned that there's going to be some kind of ad component to this, which also seems really, really smart and is also kind of consistent with what all of the streamers are realizing now, which is, you know, an ad-supported business model actually, you know, really works for these subscription services. So I think it's really interesting and does go a long way towards solving some of the problems with live sports in the streaming era. I mean, there's also, you know, a million caveats and questions. You know, the obvious one is that NBC and CBS are not a part of this. And, you know, the two of those companies own a lot of different sports rights, including, of course, a bunch of NFL rights and the Olympics, golf, etc. And then also, you know, big question still out there for, you know, local sports broadcasts. So like for me, if I want to watch, you know, a Sharks game, they're NBC. So that's already not a good example. But like, even if NBC was a part of this thing, you know, would your local NBC, you know, in our case, Sports Bay Area network be on this? So, you know, it's interesting, and it's another really good example of just how fast all of this stuff is moving. Like, I think this is an announcement that even, you know, a year ago would have seemed like something that could have happened like in the far flung future, but, you know, here we are, and it's, you know, it's happening now, and this thing is supposed to be out sometime this fall.
Yeah, this is interesting, not weird, but interesting. But also a thought that just occurred to me while you were explaining this is that when you mentioned the joint venture thing, how is this not like late 2000s Hulu again?
Well, that's so Gruber, actually, I just saw shortly before we started, you know, made that exact comparison, which is that this is, that his line was something to the effect of, this is like Hulu, but with more desperation.
I don't agree with that take, but I do think it speaks to multiple parties realizing that market confusion and not being able to, even though the sports rights are extremely valuable, you're not going to get people to sign up for enough services to make this viable to not put your content together. You know, I disagree with that take.
Well, in any case, I do think from a consumer experience perspective and a business perspective, it just makes a ton of sense for this stuff to all be in a single app. And it's what you and I have been saying for a long time, which is, hey, like the cable bundle actually kind of was, you know, a good thing, both in terms of value and in terms of ease of use. And, you know, this is very clearly a sort of return to that sort of model, sort of in the same way that the streamers embracing an ad-supported model, you know, streamers are not obviously putting all of their content under a single umbrella like what's going to happen here, but the idea of having a free ad-supported service is, you know, very consistent with how cable worked, which, you know, was heavily subsidized by ad dollars.
Well, wait, is this, there was no hint that this was going to be part of, like, what are you and, what's her name? The one who's on Downstream? Julie Alexander?
Julia.
Yeah, this isn't going to be a fast service, is it?
No, not fast, but I think I did see somewhere that they mentioned that there is going to be some sort of ad component to this, some sort of ad supported option.
Well, I also think that, like, they just have to, because ad, like, so much of sports has been, like, over the last three decades has been so heavily integrated around increasing the ad load and building the game around television broadcasts, to the point where, if you, let's say this thing, and we haven't even touched on pricing, let's say if people are expecting that it be ad free and this thing's cost $70 a month, that's not how games happen. Like, they've engineered them where they expect 3.5 minute ad breaks every 10 minutes of play or whatever. So that's just, yeah. So yeah, so it's definitely not going to be an ad free service. But I guess to that point, how much is this going to cost?
Well, one thing that I actually did miss in the excitement of seeing this a few hours ago is that the Wall Street Journal, which was the first to break this, notes that the leagues were not informed of this prior to the announcement. So, I mean, clearly there's going to be a ton of business negotiation happening here. So I think right now there's probably no concept of what the price is going to be, because, you know, the underlying rights that are going to have to be to purchase to power this thing are still very much being negotiated. So that's interesting.
Yeah, but I feel like, or I mean, like, the leagues have to get behind, like, they don't have a choice. Do. Cable bundle is cratering. Like, they're going to have no audience for it. They've already seen Diamond Sports' bankruptcy. That, like, sure, the, like, Major League Football. Wow. Show title, though. The National Football League, like, sure, they can command those types of deals, and people will, which was the game that was exclusive to Peacock that allegedly drove, like, 2.5 million subs or something to it?
Yeah, it's one of the games in the Wild Card Weekend. It was the Chiefs and Dolphins, I believe.
Got it. So, there's certain leagues and a certain subset of matchups within those top tier leagues that would drive that type of stuff. But they have to be realistic about where, a term I hate, meeting customers where they are, of knowing who's going to subscribe to what and what's actually sustainable. So they, yeah, there's definitely stuff that's going to have to happen in the negotiation side, and to give those over the top rights for those games and go streaming only, and have to deal with the, because I assume a lot of these broadcast rights packages are based off of an estimated and presumed, like, addressable market. And if you are now going to probably have maybe a fourth the eligible household being able to watch your stuff, that impacts things a little bit. Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, it's also really interesting, like, the ESPN part of this in particular, right? Because it's ESPN going over the top is something that's, you know, been rumored forever. It has been all but, you know, been confirmed by Disney. And so there'll be kind of a question of, is this their strategy, or are they doing this and some sort of standalone thing?
Well, who would pay for that? Because that's, again, going back to the pricing thing, is people have wondered, like, what would standalone ESPN cost? And people have thrown around amounts that are insane to me, because I'm a sports fan. Like, I don't like football, but I do. That is the one thing of, like, not having had cable for the past year and a half that I do miss. Like, people are saying that, like, ESPN as a standalone would be like $30 a month. That's insane. But, like, had all of it, if you had NBA on TNT and, well, that's the, but I mean, you did make a good point of this. Obviously, we're still not, sorry, several points here. Is his name John Skipper? Who's the guy that used to run ESPN?
Yeah.
So he had a really good interview, or actually, I mean, well, that's debatable. Peter Kafka had a great interview with somebody who maybe had said some, the content was fine, but he had a good throwaway line last year of, if you had all just kept paying for fucking cable, none of this would be a problem. And he had a great point, right, which is that, like, you, and he literally said, like, you guys don't know how good you had it because you're getting everything for one low price. And now this fragmented ecosystem, like, all these people that were clamoring for a la carte cable and thinking, oh yeah, I'm no longer going to pay $110 at Comcast. I'm going to pay like $14 because I'm going to get just the Food Network and Hulu and everything's great. But it's not, because now you have to pay, how much is Netflix these days? Like, I'm still on the, I don't have the 4K plan, but I don't have ads. So I think I'm paying $16 a month for Netflix. I have the Disney bundle. I sometimes have Max. I just signed up for Apple TV Plus because I want to watch Slow Horses, which, two episodes in, meh. But, like, so sure, all on the entertainment side, what, I'm now paying $50 to $60 a month for that. And then now on the sports side, how much do we think the service is going to cost? $40? I think that's probably, relative to the cost of the rights, is probably low. But I mean, I can't imagine they're going to price it much higher to get widespread adoption. So sure, we have $60 plus 40, and I still can't watch the Giants. Cable looks like, right, a fucking great, a great option. I mean, it's not anymore because, right, we've destroyed it, but
yeah. Totally.
Like, how much would you pay to, like, I know the Giants are ho-hum and you're probably, maybe, like, they're not your team, but, like, how much would you pay for an Angels, like, or just like your favorite baseball team? How much would you pay a month for that?
Well, I'm trying to think, like, you know, I'm an NBA League Pass subscriber, where they have the thing where you can subscribe and pay less to just watch one team. So I have that for the Lakers.
But is that only doable because you're out of market?
Right. Yeah. Right.
Well, I think that's a limitation that can't hold up in the modern era. Like, so you can only like a team that you don't live near. That's not.
Well, no. But I'm saying, like, it is a good proxy for
how much your willingness would I pay to pay.
Yeah. And I think that is, I think it's $100 for the season.
What's 82 games? What does the season run for? How many months? How many off months do you have?
It's also a little complicated because so League Pass doesn't include nationally broadcast games. And in the case of the Lakers, they're on national TV a bunch. So I think, you know, League Pass probably ends up giving me access to about 60 of their games or so that I otherwise wouldn't have access to.
If they make the playoffs, do you get to see that?
Well, no, that's all national TV.
That sucks. Right. That's
but, you know, to me, that's worth it. And I think, like, you know, in this hypothetical future where, you know, I don't have any sort of, you know, cable bundle thing. Like, right now I have YouTube TV. So if I were to, like, want to cancel that and could, you know, get access to like the Sharks for a season, you know, I think $100 for the season seems reasonable, but also is probably too low. Unless, you know, I think one thing that's going to be interesting to see with all of the streaming stuff, with sports and non-sports content too, is it does feel like it's early days with the advertising part of all of this. And as that continues to ramp up, I think that's going to change the pricing to all of these various streaming services. And I think there's also going to be a lot more bundling that's going to happen.
Oh,
not,
sure.
Not necessarily quite in the same way that this is happening, where it's literally like a single app. But I do think there's going to be streamers coming together to offer package deals, or I mean, there's also going to be consolidation with things like Paramount. So, yeah, it'll be really, really interesting to see how that all shakes out. But it is, you know, to return to like our very original point with all of this, is it's kind of impossible to imagine a scenario where somebody ends up paying less than they did with cable. And it's also pretty hard to envision a scenario where the user experience is even as good, let alone better, than it was just accessing everything through a cable box.
I do think it'll get better, but...
Yeah, no, it really was. So yeah, I mean, I do think that stuff will get better, but yeah, it's not going to be even on par, I think, to what we had for quite a while.
So do you think this puts the kibosh on? Because everybody's been saying like, well, actually, no, never mind. I lied, because that's going to be a future. This is a news item we're about to talk about. But because people were like, is Apple going to make any moves for more sports rights or anything like that? And I'll say probably not, because I, other than MLS and this weird Friday night baseball thing with, I'm not even sure if they still do. Yeah, people are probably not going to do much more.
I do wonder if part of what's happening here is Fox, ESPN, Fox, Disney, and Warner actually putting pressure on the leagues to not try to pursue something with like an Amazon or an Apple, because, you know, like the NBA, right, is kind of the immediate example where the rights are coming up for that. And I do wonder if part of the strategy and the timing with announcing this is, you know, going to the NBA and say, listen, like, streaming's the future. We want to figure this out. And it's going to be a lot better for you to be a part, or, you know, to keep the rights with us and be a part of this, you know, kind of bundled package thing, instead of going off into a silo with Apple or Amazon. Like, yeah, maybe you'll get a bigger check from one of those two, but you're going to, you know, completely isolate yourself and sort of risk the future of your brand with not bringing more, you know, more younger fans into the fold, etc. So I think that might be part of this too.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you have anything else on that?
I do think that that's sort of like, that's the challenge for, Apple, Amazon, all the tech companies, is I do think there's a awareness, especially with sports, where having your content on those streaming platforms just doesn't get you the reach that you had with, you know, the traditional cable bundle, and like you'd have with something like this joint venture thing.
Because
I think especially with sports, that means a lot.
Well, because you don't have the opportunity to have like a cultural moment. Because like, not everybody, like, just be like, hey, like, this is a really, really great game on right now, put it on channel 2. Like, that's not that limits how many people could possibly see this big thing to only people who are already probably watching.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I think that was today's big news. But I do think this kind of loops back to a couple of old stories, which is one. Mm-hmm. So we've been talking about for a year and a half or so. So Diamond Sports, which owns the broadcast rights to mostly Midwest stuff, and the San Diego Padres, is Diamond the one that basically took over a bunch of FSN affiliates and renamed them Bally's, infuriatingly?
Yeah. So when Disney acquired 21st Century Fox, part of, you know, what made that deal go through is Fox had to spin off all the regional sports stuff. And so they sold them all those rights to Diamond Sports, which I guess is a company, the parents, what, like Sinclair or something?
Yeah, the company, yeah.
Yeah, and they and so Diamond Sports ran all of these Bally Sports network channels for a bunch of different teams, like 37 different teams across Major League Baseball, the NBA, and the NHL.
Yeah. And then early last year, they stopped being able to make their debt payments, and things weren't looking good for them anymore. So under their bankruptcy reorganization, it's been a while. I actually don't know a lot of the terms of this, but Amazon has basically bought or given they gave a bridge loan or something to the point where they now get most of it. Not that they own it, but they now become the streaming partner for all that stuff.
So the gist here is that Diamond Sports wants to spin off and become its own thing. So they've declared bankruptcy. They want to get out from under Sinclair and just become their own company. And so they're negotiating this like $450 million plan with all of their creditors in order to execute on this. And so of that $450 million, Amazon's putting in $115 million. So, and I guess there's the potential for them to invest like another $50 million. So a little under half is what I guess they could end up putting into this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really interesting. And it's all kind of pending approval from the bankruptcy judge that's overseeing this. There's a lot of questions about sort of how this would work. I mean, Amazon came out and said the obvious thing, which is a lot of this stuff is going to be on Prime Video, but exactly what that looks like is going to be a big open question. And I'll put a link to The Athletic did a really good, clear write-up of everything that's happening here, and I'll put that in the notes.
Okay. And then... what was the other thing? There was one other big sports story in the past 2 weeks.
There was a story about the NFL buying a stake in ESPN. Well,
so is this the... Because Iger, in that whole Sun Valley interview that pissed everybody off, was this the strategic partner they were hoping for? Or is this fit that definition?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Okay, so what does the NFL get? Or what is this?
There's not really much else that's come out about this since, you know, the news was kind of initially rumored. I think the NFL having more control has got to be a big part of this. The NFL have a direct seat at the table for shaping a lot of how this streaming stuff, you know, works out. And then, of course, you know, ESPN gets the money that they need.
Okay. All right. And yeah, I think any other sports or streaming stuff?
I don't think so. It's just, it's amazing. Amazing how fast all of this stuff is coming together. I mean, it makes sense. Like it kind of has to, and in some ways, because of how, you know, rapidly the cable bundle is falling apart. But still, it's kind of amazing it's happening.
Oh, unrelated, but we'll probably never get around to it. There were some updates. You probably got a couple emails from the Disney company. Hulu and Disney Plus are now, they've revised their subscriber agreement basically they saw how well the password crackdown is working for Netflix at juicing the stock and the earnings, where they are now, what was the terminology? They've added a section to their customer agreement that says, we're adding limitations on sharing your account outside your household and explaining how we may assess your compliance with these limitations. So, makes sense. I've always never really subscribed to the idea of hipster cable, but also I'm no one to talk because sometimes I find stuff that fell off a truck. But, like, yeah, they're apparently going to go pretty heavy-handed on making sure that people aren't, sharing the passwords anymore. So, yeah. I mean, it looks like everybody is really turning the screws on making sure their streaming units are getting as close to profitability as they can.
I hear profitability is the name of the game these days.
Since when? All right.
As of about
a year and a half ago.
18 months ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If I see somebody,
since money wasn't free anymore,
if I see somebody write ZERP again on the internet, I'm going to lose my mind.
What is that?
Ugh.
Do I want to know?
No.
Maybe I should.
No, zero interest rate phenomenon. Everybody keeps using anytime they talk about anything related to tech changing because profitability matters all of a sudden. They keep talking about it as being ZERP related. And it's an acronym that, I mean, like, I get the concept and it's a valid concept, but it's just now a buzzword. Like, I don't know.
It's a bit of a upsetting acronym. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Do we have anything else? Let's talk about, before we talk about the Vision Pro briefly, you actually had some online anecdata related to electric vehicles.
Oh yeah.
So I wanted as much as you want to share with that. So basically the sure. journal had, and I actually thought this was fairly even handed. I think there's a lot about this that frustrates me that I think is maybe not, because so the headline here is GM went all in on EVs. Dealers say buyers want hybrids. I think before this transition, they would say nobody wants stupid hybrids, but I dispute the idea that GM went all in on EVs. I think GM is wasting a ton of time making stuff that doesn't matter, like the Hummer EV, when they could just try to make a good car that's an electric vehicle, which they still haven't actually done. Like, they made the Volt, which is the one that's all electric. They made the Bolt EUV.
The Bolt.
And yeah. Then they made the Blazer that has software that won't stay on while you drive the car. And then they made a bunch of, like, weird-ass, like, cars that nobody actually wants that... versus what Tesla does, which is make poorly built cars that are actually mostly good cars. So anyway, people are saying that the market, there's been this whole narrative for the past 3 months in particular that the American consumer is rejecting electric vehicles and they're staying on the lot forever. And why would anybody want one anymore? I think there's probably a little bit to that, but and that's related to the fact that one, EVs have not come down in price. There is not a budget EV that is a good unqualified recommendation yet, and I'm including the Model 3 in that probably. And then apparently there was some summit with Mary Barra and with GM, and they're now saying that, oh no, nobody wants EVs. The dealers are all saying that consumers want plug-in hybrids, which again, I don't think that was the dealer's party line a year ago, but anyway. So I guess I want, like, what is your thought on the state of the market? And also, I think you had either a friend or a family member or something happen recently where you actually do have some real world data about what current buying motives are these days.
Yeah. I mean, to me, plug-in hybrids have always made a ton of sense. Like you mentioned the Chevy Volt. I actually always thought that was a really, really interesting car. And that car basically is the model for, you know, most plug-in hybrids that have come since then. And, you know, the idea here is that, you know, unlike a traditional hybrid, a plug-in hybrid can actually power itself, you know, fully on electricity for some number of miles, which is not the case with a hybrid where you're, you know, as the name implies, you're sort of constantly you know, leveraging battery power and gas power together. But a plug-in hybrid is really interesting, where you can get, you know, 30, 40 miles completely on battery. So for a lot of people, that means that you basically have an EV. Like, if you're somebody who really doesn't drive more than, you know, 30, 40 miles in any given day, you're very seldom going to use, you know, any gas in the car. And on the, you know, rare occasion where you are driving longer distances, you have the benefit of just being able to fill up a gas tank instead of having to, you know, strategically map your route to where, you know, the nearest fast charger is, which for, you know, a lot of people is kind of a, you know, something that they're just not really going to be willing to do at this point, given the state of, you know, the EV charging infrastructure. And so, yeah, I mean, like, my personal anecdote is the lady's friend's parents, they were in the market for a new car last year. And I think we're kind of originally thinking about going fully electric with something like a Model Y. But the, you know, the more they looked into it, they started finding these plug-in hybrids. And for them, you know, they fit right in that sort of, you know, type of driver where they very, very rarely are driving longer distances. And then when they do, like, do they really want to be thinking about charging and all of that? And so they ended up going with, it's, I think it's the RAV4 Prime, which is Toyota's plug-in hybrid version of the RAV4. It gets, you know, I think around 40, 45 miles of range on battery, and then another few hundred miles on gas. And I think in the first, you know, 6-7 months they had it, they may have filled up the gas tank once. And, you know, it's was significantly cheaper than the equivalent sized EV would have been. And, you know, because they, you know, really only ever have to charge it at home, they're not worrying about charging it on long car trips or anything. It's also just a lot simpler to use than an EV. So yeah, I mean, to me, plug-in hybrids, like, yeah, I mean, it's hard to make a real strong argument for pushing a full EV versus a plug-in hybrid. I mean, of course, unless you want to make the, you know, the environmental argument, but I mean, even that, I think it's a little complicated with battery recycling and everything. But just from a consumer perspective, in terms of price and in terms of experience, it is really hard to make the counter argument that a plug-in hybrid isn't better than an EV.
I would say some of that's because I would say that all makes a lot of sense, and plug-in hybrids have always been occupied this weird space. Because I remember when I was looking for a replacement car in 2020, I was looking at their Volvo had the XC60, and they had a version that had was a plug-in hybrid, but the range on it was only on full battery. Was only 15 miles.
Yeah, but Volvo's a bad... I've looked into that too, but Volvo's a bad example though, because their plug-in hybrids have always been way, way overpriced and haven't been very good.
Well, that's what I'm saying, which is that I think I was once just very... Like, I was looking like if I wanted to make myself the most boring person in the world, if I chose to get a Prius Prime... Like, what? How much range do you get from that? And I think those are 35 miles.
Yeah, probably.
Which is fine. Actually, I think even me, like, I have kind of a longer commute than most people, and that almost gets me there and home. Like, it's an interesting thing, but I do... The part that bugs me or that I think is challenging is that, because Consumer Reports generally does good work, but there's always, they release like these quarterly things, and they had a whole thing about, oh, EVs are much more costly and much more like fault prone than any other cars. And I do think that's a lot of it, that EVs are new and a lot of them are high end. So therefore repairs and maintenance are more expensive. But on a very basic abstracted level, EVs should require fewer repairs because they have less required maintenance and fewer moving parts. And I do think that is the one knock against PHEVs, is that you have to maintain two separate, not drivetrains, but two, you have an electric motor and you have it's a gas car. So I think that is the big downside, but you haven't seen the clear cut thing in favor of electric cars, because a lot of electric cars still aren't great. And a lot of that is because, like, I just, the GM thing kills me, is because they're just not making the car that people want. And very few people actually are. Like, Tesla kind of is, but, like, just make a regular affordable car. Like, you don't have to make a...
Well, Chevy almost, or GM, almost gave up before they started.
What do you mean?
Which is, well, I mean, they said they were all in on EVs. And, you know, to your earlier point, like, before they really even started shipping EVs that people cared about and could afford, they're already pivoting away from that. Like, they didn't really even try.
Well, that's the thing. They made, is it called the Itanium? No, Itanium is Intel. Is it the Ultium? Well, what's the new thing where they had to make a new Bolt? Because they're like, oh, we're changing battery platforms.
Yeah, that.
Maybe Ultium. But yeah, like, they made, like, that dumbass Hummer EV pickup truck. They made something called the Cadillac Lyriq, which is not, like, horrible, right. But I mean, it's a $80,000, like, it's a very high end, like, luxury SUV, yeah, from a brand that doesn't really have the brand cachet to command that price. They just haven't actually tried making the car that people want. Like, even though it kind of has a soft spot in my heart because I kind of like ugly cars, like, the Bolt EUV, I think, is a cute car, and as a city car, it could be fun. But then they were like, oh no, we're done with CarPlay, and actually this is the last car that's ever going to use our old battery system, so see ya, suckers. Like, you don't get to have credit for trying if you haven't actually shipped a car in mass that's the type of car Americans want.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the other challenge here too, which every car manufacturer is going to have to figure out, is, yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, crossover SUVs, full-size SUVs, like, bigger cars are certainly, you know, back in style again, at least here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And the reality is that there just are no good, affordable, fully electric SUVs. I mean, yes, I know there's the Model Y, but I mean, that's a relatively small crossover. Like, if you want a more full size 3-row SUV, you just, I mean, I'll raise my hand here. I mean, that's certainly something I'm interested in, but there are no affordable fully electric options there.
I mean, there actually is, but it's really ugly.
Which one?
I think for your,
oh, the
EV9. EV9 is a hideous fucking car, but I do think that meets all your requirements.
You know, it's fair. That is actually something that I'm excited about, you know, not because that's the car that I want, but because I'm hoping it, you know, is popular and puts pressure on the market to come out with more cars like it. But yeah, you know, you're right. Like, that is actually the first example of a, you know, full-size SUV that's fully electric, that's, you know, pretty reasonably priced. I think it starts like at 56,000 or thereabout. Because outside of that, I mean, you're looking at, like, the R1S, which starts in like the $85,000 range, or the Model X, which is kind of the same way. I mean, there aren't that many options, and the ones that are there are just nowhere close to most people's price range.
Yeah, it sucks. Like, that's why I'm happy I bought my car. Like, I really want a full electric car, but there's not gonna be a good mass market, slightly luxury-ish car that's not a Elmo mobile. And even then, I would take issue with the fact that the Model Y is not a luxury vehicle. Like, it's just going to be a while before there are good... I guess, do you buy into the fact that Americans are souring on EVs? Like, do you think it's a fact that, like, they just still don't have good options? Or do you think the politics and the current economic reality... Do you actually think Americans are dismissing EVs wholesale, and that's going to set back the movement?
I guess I haven't, I mean, obviously I haven't looked at like the hard data around this. I don't necessarily know if consumer sentiment has changed all that much. I still think there's always been a lot of just uncertainty around somebody making their first EV purchase. I mean, I think a real big problem is that like Ford and GM and others, like when they made these declarations about going all electric, it kind of just didn't even really seem like they actually had a plan for how they were going to do that, like at scale and in a way that consumers would be interested. Like, I mean, like you were saying earlier, I mean, GM coming out with the Hummer being one of their first EVs. I mean,
it's a 9,000 pound car that's hideous and also insanely expensive.
Like over $100,000. Yeah. Like it makes absolutely no sense. And then, I mean, also ironically with GM, like their one EV that actually has been pretty popular with consumers, they're not going to make anymore for a while. And I mean, I think they're coming out with it again in like a couple of years, but.
Wait, they didn't scrap the Blazer, did they? Like they're not selling
the Bolt, oh, okay. They're stopping, or actually maybe already have stopped at this point making it, right. And then they're going to bring it out again when it's switched over to this new platform.
Can you still buy a Chevy Volt? Like, does Chevy still make a plug-in hybrid that you can buy new?
Oh, the Volt, no.
So they don't have any plug-in hybrids, probably.
I don't believe so. No.
Huh. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I find all that like kind of interesting, but also like. I was very optimistic about the Ford F-150 Lightning, but did they basically just stop there? Oh, well, no, they've got the, I think the Mach-E is fine. I think that's probably, well, I think that is the, maybe. I know we've had you and Jim Farley have beef because you think he does some Bezos charts and the fact that he claims that he's the number two EV automaker without any type of like scale, that just pisses you off. But, I think that was close, and the Mach-E is fine. I still think that's, well, I mean, actually, what am I even saying? Like, I don't, Americans don't buy sedans anymore. So like, well, I guess what else are they? The Mach-E probably is the car that Americans want. They just don't want to buy it.
The Mach-E, yeah, but the Mach-E is also, it was also not, it's not very big. I mean, you know, it markets itself as a crossover SUV, just like the way a Model Y does. But I mean, Go test drive one of those things. It's not a very big car. I mean, it's doesn't look like a sedan, but in terms of, you know, room, it's a taller sedan, basically.
Again, I'm a pioneer. Everybody thinks my car is ugly, but now every single car looks like an SUV that somebody stepped on. And I mean, that's yeah. But that's what every single when you're saying there are no good options, there's the Hyundai Ioniq 6, maybe something like that. There's the
horribly ugly.
Well, yeah, but that's
no offense.
Oh, but. No, sure. Like, yeah, it's a disgusting car. And actually, have we ever had a hot take on that? I mean, matte paint or like that whole thing is a bad look, right?
Most of the time,
I think basically 1,000,000% of the time, because anybody who has a car, you know to change lanes because they're probably a dick in traffic, and also your car's just ugly. But I mean, yeah, but there's the Ioniq, like all of those cars look exactly the same. The Mach-E, the Tesla Model Y, the Ioniq 6, is there an EV6 from Kia?
There is, yeah. That's another popular one that's also just
really fucking ugly.
Really, really not a good looking car. Yeah, well, I mean, the other thing though too, and I don't, I'm not picking on Ford. I'm rooting for Ford. I want them to pull off this mythical 3-row EV they keep teasing that they say is going to be affordable. I would love for that to be my next car. But I mean, even like the Mach-E and the Ford F-150 Lightning, I mean, go actually price those out. They're surprisingly expensive. And you know, I like the F-150. I mean, just literally looks like an F-150. So I mean, it looks fine, but you know, it's a pickup truck. So yeah, that's got to be what you're in the market for. And then, you know, with the Mach-E, it's a, you know, pretty expensive sedan plus, basically.
Harsh. Also, to round out this topic, we already solved this like six episodes ago. The Chrysler Pacifica is a plug-in hybrid that has
such a good car,
and that has 32 miles of all electric range. So just go trade in your Model 3 and get this over with, and just put on your dad hat and just embrace the fact that you're going to have a fucking minivan.
Don't you doubt that thought has occasionally crossed my mind. I haven't actually done the hard math, but if I traded in my Model 3 and got one of those, the math would be pretty favorable.
But, I mean, you'd probably have to adopt some other vice or some like hard edged like hobby just to
balance things out.
Yeah. You'd have to get like a third gaming PC or something.
Get a bunch of tattoos or something.
Or frosted tips. I know a guy. All right. Let's do a quick teaser into a future episode about VR and the Vision Pro.
Okay.
So it came out last Friday.
It did. Mm-hmm.
How's yours?
still in Apple's R&D lab, because the version I'm gonna buy is not out yet.
Mine's pretty good.
Of course it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm surprised that it doesn't feel like a first generation product.
Did you really buy one?
I did. Except I did.
Of course
you did.
Except
I didn't. God, no.
No.
But we've covered on this. I've never ever used a VR product ever.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a friend that works for the Facebook, and I was given a loaner Quest 3.
Oh, okay.
So
I should look. I don't know anything about the Quest 3.
See, that's the thing is I have like in terms of my VR experience, one, I've literally never strapped one to my face up until 3 days ago. And
oh dear, this thing is, Not a looker.
It's fine. Oof. But here's the thing. Well, and also we'll talk probably next week about like my fundamental disagreement about VR as being a valid computing platform. But the Quest 3, my familiarity with this product line was so out of date that I still thought it was called the Oculus Rift. Is that a thing? Was that a thing?
No, that was the. I think that was the original one, the one that I built a PC for way back in the day.
Wait, so was that not a self-contained thing? Like you had to have?
No. The first generation one absolutely did not do anything unless it was plugged into a very high-end PC with like literally like three or four different cables.
Okay, so it was a mess or whatever.
Yeah, it was a complete mess. Yeah,
so I can't imagine that having ever been good.
Oh no, it wasn't.
But people thought it was good. I think everybody, if you were in like that circle, like people thought like Oculus Rift, like this thing's great.
The market pretty quickly shifted towards these standalone headset things.
Yeah. So the Quest 3, one, I am. You are correct in that it doesn't look great, but
no.
I guess what part of it doesn't look great to you? You don't like it's white?
I don't like the major like TiVo Bolt vibes for sure.
Not Bolt. I thought it was called the Edge. Isn't it the one where it was all slanty?
I thought the one that came in white was the Bolt. I don't remember.
You think of the car? No, that is the one that doesn't sit flat. Oh, that's funny. Forgot that.
the camera thing in the front, like with the three cameras, is weird looking.
Correct. So I'm going to give you like maybe a couple of quick points, and I'll flesh this out more before the next episode. But this is a VR headset, correct?
Well, it does. This one does pass through, right?
So is that a concept? So again, no familiarity with this. I had no idea what pass through meant. Was that a concept that you did the Oculus Rift that you had, or like didn't you have like an HTC Vive as well?
Oh no, I only had that original Oculus headset, and then kind of bailed.
So that had no cameras or whatsoever. Like there was
no
spatial awareness or whatever.
Correct. Yeah.
Like, yeah, I have been like so ignored this segment that I didn't know that pass through was already a thing. Like the Vision Pro, the whole thing that they're trying to convince people is amazing about it is that you put it on and it's like you didn't put it on. Like that you just immediately like you see your surroundings and you can just now see recipe apps and timers and a bunch of BS that you aren't actually going to use this headset for. But like that you just see the rest of the world. And I thought like, oh wait, did Apple invent that? No, they didn't. Like, so the Oculus Quest 3 or the Facebook headset came out last October. But before that, they had the Quest 2. They've had other ones. And pass-through was already a concept that existed. But
yeah, HTC's had pass-through for a while too, I think.
So I think that's the thing that makes me hate this a lot less than I thought I was going to. Because, yeah, I still have all the fundamental hatred of this being an isolating product. But the one thing that I actually think is pretty solid about it is that you can just tap it twice on the side and you can see, like, your apartment in the world. Like, I thought anytime you used a VR product, like, you had to, like... Again, like I haven't seen The Matrix in 20 years, but you're strapping into The Matrix and that you're sitting on the couch and you're not moving. Like, it's better than it used to be. It's still a very isolating and not great product in that way, but you don't have to take the headset off all the time. And that, I think, changes the game in a lot of ways where relative to the news of the week, which is the Vision Pro and... is this the second coming of the Mac and the whole thing of like, there's this big Vanity Fair profile of Tim Cook where he's on the cover wearing the fucking Vision Pro with a bunch of frames and pictures he hasn't hung in his office, which that's frustrating for other reasons. Like, is the Vision Pro 7 times better than the Quest 3? And the answer is no. I think this is a very, I'll flesh this out more. But I think this is actually a very, very impressive product.
So the knock on these headsets that have offered like the whole pass-through thing before is that the quality has been really poor.
Well, so that's what I was looking at, is that the Quest 2 apparently only did pass-through in grayscale.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
This actually, if it's daytime... really high quality and good. Like in nighttime when it has to like jack up the ISO and less good. But it's surprisingly okay. Oddly, like I'm never going to buy one, I don't think. But because I'm never going to use it for anything, but like loading up so I did two things with it so far. Or I did three things. One, there's a game where you pretend you're boxing, and that's actually kind of fun. This thing is like Wii Sports, but like if Nintendo kept iterating on Wii Sports. I also watched the like an hour of the Taylor Swift Eras Tour movie in it, and that's an experience. I actually do think there's something to the idea of entertainment consumption in VR. Not games, but I mean like just entertainment. And I just loaded up a browser, and like these are not OLED screens in here, and I guess that is what you get with the Vision Pro, but it's like the text is super sharp and it's very, very, very fast, and like it's good. I it's a complicated product that I will like maybe let my thoughts marinate on, but I still think the Vision Pro, I just don't think anybody can have a conversation about the Vision Pro without prefacing every sentence with it's $3,500. Like, I don't think anybody gets to say that it's a good product, but like, they're like, everybody's like, oh, it does all this stuff, but, or it's a first generation product, but it's just so much more absurdly expensive and irrational because of that, where people can be like, oh, like the quality is so much better than the Quest or whatever, but it's literally 7 times as expensive. I still think I'm going to refuse to go to the Apple Store and get a demo of it. But this is interesting. Yeah. Anyway. So we'll get back to that. Have you, Ashley, let me ask you, and you can summarize real quick, and then we'll wrap up. So how was this week's upgrade? I guess what is the opinion, and what's the discourse like from people who are very, that really, really want to like the Vision Pro?
Well, I think so. To address upgrade specifically, I thought it was a really good episode. I mean, they both, Jason and Mike, are you know, seem like they're really enjoying the Vision Pro, but they spent most of the time talking about the things that they don't like as much about it. So that, you know, that's always kind of interesting. It was not a, I mean, you know, there are parts where, you know, Mike is his kind of typical excited self, but that, you know, that's okay. But otherwise I thought it was a pretty even-handed assessment of the platform. I thought, like, in terms of reading the reviews, it was the contrast between The Verge's review and Gruber's review that really sort of, I think, crystallized what I think is sort of like the central question or debate around Vision Pro. And it sort of like, it boils down to whether like the Vision, you know, eventual, like, you know, family of products, or like this idea of like spatial computing, like, is that really the next Mac or the next iPhone, like the next big leap in consumer computing technology, you know, or is it not? And I won't read like the full quotes. I'll put links to the reviews in the notes, but essentially the Verge's review by Nilay Patel, you know, has a line that's basically to the effect of, we can only review what's in the box. Like, we can only give you our impression of what's shipping today, you know, not what could hypothetically come in the future. Whereas, you know, Gruber just flat out says that this initial product is the 1984 Macintosh, and this is the beginning of the next big thing in consumer computing. And I mean, look, he could be right, but I just think taking that as a given today with what the Vision Pro is super, super premature. And I was kind of thinking of, about like a comparison today to like self-driving cars, where I think like both in the case of whatever you want to call it, spatial computing, AR, mixed reality, like whatever you want to call this sort of like category of products, I think, you know, most people would acknowledge over an infinite time scale, that's probably where personal computing is going. Like some sort of device or contact lenses or something where this, you know, digital information is just sitting directly on top of your vision in a way where you don't actually have to be holding a separate device with a screen. Like that's probably where this is going. In the same way that, like, it's kind of a given that, like, again, over an infinite time scale, cars will, for the most part, just drive themselves. But I think there's huge questions with both of those as to how quickly that's going to happen. Like, and I could see I could see both taking way, way, way longer than we think. And I think that's where leaping to the conclusion that, you know, Apple has its next Macintosh or next iPhone now may not shake out, right? Because, I mean, I guess the Mac would be a little bit of a better comparison in the sense that, you know, personal PCs, you know, did take really a couple of decades after 1984 to become truly mainstream, whereas it happened quite a bit more quickly with the iPhone. But yeah, I just think that's sort of the central question with Vision Pro is do we have the next big leap in personal computing with this device or with the device that's going to come after this, or is that a bit more uncertain or a bit more further down the road than we think?
I think that's fair. Or I think that's kind of the central conversation that kind of is coloring having a rational debate or thinking this through, because I think we'd both agree that actually, do you agree with the statement that the Vision Pro in its current state is basically a public beta and it's a glorified developer kit for early adopters?
Yeah, I would agree with that. And then I guess I'd also add one other quick thing, which is also, I think, another big point of contention with the device, which is, you know, Apple's marketing it as being not an AR headset or a VR mm-hmm. headset. You know, they're calling it a spatial computer, and they're emphasizing through marketing and through product features how it's not an isolating device and how, you know, you're totally in tune with the world around you and with the people around you. And like, I know for me, and I think for like a lot of people, like that, I mean, that's just BS. Like it's an AR headset.
You mean a VR headset?
Or it's a VR headset, you know. And Apple not embracing that just seems really silly. Like pretending that this device is something that it's not.
Like, again, I think we talked about this last week and you kind of disagreed, but I think your main thesis was that, oh, so what is Apple supposed to do? Just keep iterating in silence until it's good enough? And which actually, isn't that supposed to be the Apple way? But that is the thing where they're trying to pretend it's a product that it'll be in 5 to 10 years versus what's actually shipping today. And this is an extremely isolating VR headset that has slightly, now that I know what the term means and I've actually experienced it, better than average pass-through, which for the wearer is a benefit. But for everybody else, you're still a prick in a headset.
I mean, I think the other part too, which is kind of ties like the marketing question with sort of everything we're talking about here, is like literally I'm looking on like just apple.com right now and it's Vision Pro, welcome to the era of spatial computing.
Like they're hyped, they're like, again, the Tobias quote, they're like, they're blowing their wad, like they're marketing that it's the fully like fleshed out product, and it's not even close to that currently.
Right.
And that's
exactly.
And yeah. Also, man, from every review, the eyesight feature apparently is really terrible.
Yeah,
and it's a lot of what makes the headset really expensive, apparently.
Yeah, it's actually been, I think, arguably the most surprising thing in the reviews that have come out. Like something that I did not have on my Vision Pro bingo card. Like I've always figured that eyesight would be just really, really goofy and weird and would generally be rejected by most people as a good idea and as something that Apple would probably get away from.
But you also probably thought it was going to be it was going to be good to start with.
But I also, in my head, I always thought like the reviews would say like, technically, really, really impressive. Like it would have this like, you know, super high quality display. And, you know, maybe if you glance at somebody out of the corner of your eye wearing one of those things, like it actually for maybe a fleeting moment would actually look like, you know, they were looking at you or something. Like it would be technically impressive. But yeah, but apparently it's not. Like apparently the screen is really, really dim and it just doesn't look very good. And that I've been really surprised by that. And that just makes that whole feature all the more baffling because I don't think it was going to be well received, even if it was technically really impressive. And now that it's not even that,
it's just a feature that Apple thought would give them the wiggle room to not, like, because it's not hard to understand why Apple, and they haven't cracked any of that, that they thought that would somehow make it feel less isolating. And that would be like their big, like, oh, well, no, but you can still, it's wearing it around other people is not weird because we have this thing. And they were so devoted to that idea, and it never actually happened.
They painted themselves into a corner with, you know, years and years of Tim Cook talking about how, you know, VR headsets were so isolating and how that wasn't something Apple was interested in. So if they, you know, if they shipped this thing with just, you know, a black front or a Meta Quest thing where there's just like three weird looking cameras on the front, that would be, that'd probably be pretty tough for them to square. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, honestly, they probably would have been better off doing that because presumably this thing would have been less expensive. They wouldn't have had all the reviewers talking about kind of how crummy the feature is. And it, you know, it could have just become another, you know, we're never going to make a video iPod moment, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, Apple just sometimes says stuff that they end up doing a 180 on. I mean, that honestly, like to me, that would be, if this thing was like,
if it was $2,000,
you know, $1,000 cheaper, or if, yeah, $1,500 cheaper, and Apple just came out and said, look, this is the best VR headset on the market today. That to me would just be a lot more interesting and a lot more genuine. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've also been intrigued by, like, I thought, like, I'm sure you listen to like the Six Colors podcast. I thought Dan's initial impression was really, really interesting, which is, and it got at something I was really, that I've been thinking about, which is, you know, this has been such a hyped device by so many different people. And, you know, his initial impression was like, yeah, you know, it is impressive, but, you know, you're still looking at two displays in a headset where, like, the lighting is kind of like dimmer than you'd expect it to be. And he was pointing out all these things where it was just like, yeah, you know, I bet when you're actually using this thing, it's not like some magical thing. Like, it is still just a, you know, pair of really high-end OLED screens strapped to your head.
Slap that on the box.
and I feel also the same way. I think I said this to you offline online where, like, you know, Marques Brownlee had some really, really good videos, and others have had some really good videos as well, like actually showing the device in use, because you can AirPlay out and, you know, capture the video. And as I've watched all those videos, I just like, I can't tell if it's making me more or less interested in like trying one of these things, because there are parts of the experience that do look really interesting. Like, you pointed this out with the Quest 3 as well. Like, media consumption seems like, yeah, it would probably be like really neat. But any video I've seen where like somebody's doing more of like, I guess what Apple would call like the spatial computing where you've just got like a bunch of windows around, or you're like screen sharing from a Mac or whatever. Like
so let's,
all that stuff. Just, so
let's,
I don't know.
Let's save that for next week because I didn't put it in the show notes because I just read it like an hour before we started. Ben Thompson on Certechery had a really good thing about, he was very, 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 very excited and bought in. And his realization is just that, oh, actually for productivity, this thing isn't very good.
Yeah.
Like let's put a pin in that one because that, I think that's a very valid point where his thesis is that because of some decisions they made to make sure that the multimedia experience was fantastic, it's actually pretty bad about a lot of other stuff, and actually getting work done is not good on it. So yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think in an alternate universe where I bought one of these things, I feel like I would totally have the same experience as Dan Morin, where I'd like put it on and kind of be like, yeah, no, this is really good, but it's like not quite as good as I thought it was going to be. Well, and like I'm never really going to use it for like any kind of traditional computing tasks. And what I'm going to end up doing is putting it on every once in a while when I want to watch a movie.
It's the delta between technical impressiveness and utility.
Yeah, right. Like a tech demo versus something you actually use day to day.
Yeah. All right. So to be continued for next week or next episode. Yeah. All right. Got a chef special for me?
I do. It's maybe not. It's not like the most inspired one, and I'm very, very, very late to the party on this, but Marques Brownlee's YouTube channel.
Yeah.
MKBHD. I've seen some of his stuff in the past, but I've been watching his Vision Pro stuff, which I think is really kind of the first videos of his that I've really watched like start to finish. And he's great. He's really, really good. Hot take.
Sorry, I'm only gonna mock for 1 second just because, hold on, I was supposed to say, he has 18 million followers on YouTube, so yep. Not an early adopter.
Yep.
No, he's great. And also I do think, so do you use YouTube like on the Apple TV? Are you logged into the YouTube app?
Probably not.
I mean, subscribe to his channel. Like I like him because his main thing is like, well, I think he's one, he's super smart and like insight. He balances being a gigantic, extremely well-versed nerd with making very approachable videos that kind of are highly produced and like very easy to consume, and aren't wonky, but do have like a level of like depth and rigor to them that's a really hard thing to kind of square. Yeah. So he's damn good. And he also, if you haven't seen it before, he has a side channel called Autofocus, for cars, mostly EVs. It's pretty great.
Mm-hmm.
Do I have anything? Did I already pick the Sonos 5 before? Let's do that again. Good speaker.
I know you talked about it last time. I forget if you actually made it a chef special.
No, it's great. Also, well, actually, that'll bring up one weird thing that's kind of an anti-chef special. The Sonos Move is a really weird, frustrating product because can you guess how much power it takes to charge it over USB-C?
I'm guessing a lot.
A lot. You basically need like a laptop charger. It needs at least a 36 watt. Because I kept remembering, like, why is this not charging just using like a charger I use for an iPhone 15, and it just doesn't do anything. And there's not really any place to find this information. And yeah, you basically need like a MacBook charger if you don't have that weird, like inductive dock thingy. Anyway, so two cheers and one thumbs down for Sonos.
Yeah. So Sonos definitely has a little bit of that Apple part of them where
they don't explain what's going on.
And they don't want you, like, it's like when you go into any of their products, especially like their sound bars and stuff, like there's some EQ stuff, but like they really don't want you to be like kind of fiddling with anything. They just want you to plug in their stuff and use it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's
and if something's not working as expected, there's just generally not any troubleshooting things you can do.
Oh yeah, welcome to the era of spatial audio.